Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. I'm Kate Koff, editor of the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor is the nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We're a nonprofit organization dedicated to delivering high-quality, nonpartisan, investigative, and explanatory journalism to inform Mainers about issues impacting our state and to empower them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. Each month, a panel of reporters and editors will talk about the stories we're working on, many of which you've likely read in your local newspaper or at themainemonitor.org. This month, I'm joined by Yasmin Khan and Stacey Zhang, two excellent young reporters who have joined us this summer. Yasmin comes to us from Harvard University with a background in magazine journalism. Stacey comes to us from Amherst College with a background in local reporting. We're going to talk to Stacey and Yasmin about the stories they've been reporting for the Monitor this summer, about their plans and experiences trying to make careers in a field that seems continuously to be in tumult. Yasmin and Stacey, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So I'd like to start by asking each of you to tell us a little bit about your background and how you first became interested in journalism. So Stacey, let's start with you. When did you first become interested in journalism and what was it that drew you to the field?
Yeah, so I first got involved in journalism in high school. And as a freshman, I was just looking for things to get involved in. And journalism was one of the things where I was like, I could potentially be good at this. And it was a cool way to potentially learn about campus, to talk to new people, and also really enjoyed writing at the time. And it was an opportunity to write stuff that was also relevant to people on campus. And so I wrote my first couple stories, and I really enjoyed just, you know, learning about random things on campus, doing some hard-hitting journalism on a high school campus. And I got really interested from there and continued to do journalism in college. And here we are.
Here we are. We're going to talk a little bit about your first journalism experiences. But first, Yasmin, tell us, so same question. When did you first become interested in journalism and what was it that drew you to the field?
Sure. So I started journalism when I started college. My freshman fall, I joined the magazine that I now edit. I had done a lot of creative writing in high school, namely fiction, and I wanted to continue writing, but I wanted to explore another genre. Journalism, specifically magazine journalism, which is what I started off in, combined a prioritization of style that you get in creative writing with public engagement and community impact. Through reporting, I got to talk to people on campus and in the greater Boston area, and my pieces contributed to campus discourse. So I really fell in love with that blend.
Yeah, that's a really interesting sort of trajectory. I feel like, creative writing and journalism can be very different. I also was interested in creative writing when I first got started and realized that, you know, the writing you have to do in journalism is typically very different, but the magazine provides kind of a nice overlap there. I would love to hear from both of you, you know, what role news and journalism played in your lives growing up. Like, where did your families get their information? Were they, you know, were they your big newspaper families where it was always on the table? You guys listening to the radio all the time? Was it absent from your lives? What did that look like for you growing up? Stacey, we can start with you.
Yeah. This is an interesting question because I think I didn't have a phone till pretty late on in maybe like late middle school. So I didn't have a lot of internet access as a kid. And I can't remember what I was thinking about the world or the news, but I think a lot of that come from just being really eager to watch the TV regardless of what's on. So I definitely had a lot of cable news in my life before and after lunchtime with my family. Alongside if I could get like children's TV on, that would be great. But sometimes it's just cable news. And that would also be interesting to someone who didn't have a lot of internet access. But I think as time went on, when I had my phone and when, everybody started having their phone, social media had a larger and larger role in how me and my family are getting news. Just getting a lot of information from Instagram, Facebook. And so I think traditional media has definitely decreased in the role that it plays on, even, as a journalist, it played a less of a role in how I was getting information. I think I was looking at this question and I just remembered, I think I had a like newspaper selling job as a kid one summer, and that was really fun to be engaged in traditional news that way. And I remember it was like an early morning job. You have to go pack the newspaper, and there was a rush of feeling like, oh, I have the freshest news out there, and I'm gonna give it to people. And so that was a pretty cool experience
You
of
had a
how
paper route.
I was a pe paper delivery boy for a
Yeah.
little while.
That's a rare thing nowadays. Yeah. Well, of course, I didn't even mention phones. Yeah, we will talk a little bit about where you and your peers get your news, because that is really interesting what you just said, that right, phones are primarily where people get their information now, and especially on social media. Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So Yasmin, what about you? What did news look like in your household growing up?
Yeah, so growing up, I remember a lot of television. The biggest local station was KPRC, Channel 2 News in Houston. Shout out to them. But I also remember CNN, NBC, particularly the Nightly News Hour with Lester Holt. My mom is a religious watcher of the Today Show, which is the morning hours are news, and then the second half is more lifestyle. So certainly I would say broadcast was how my household got most of their news when I was young. I will say that around the 2016 election, so when I was 12, I do feel like reading the news became an issue of more importance in my household. And I know my mother is a subscriber to the New York Times, and we'll also read like the Texas Tribune, which is a statewide nonprofit outlet in Texas. I'm from Texas. I don't know if I've said that already. But yeah, I would say from there on, and then maybe a little more during the pandemic, written news became a bigger part of the household media diet. Although I will add that we mostly read the digital platform, so through websites or the apps for these different outlets. I don't think we get much print to our house.
It's interesting that both of you are talking about television news and broadcast journalism, which is not the fields that you are seem to be interested in at this point in your careers. Now, do either of you watch TV news now? Have you kind of continued that after you left home?
I would say that in college, because I don't have access to a TV, I don't really watch TV news anymore. So it's a lot of, getting my information from social media, but also referencing digital news outlets, whether that's local reporting or national papers like the New York Times or the Washington Post, which my college has access to. So that's been pretty nice to be able to access those, but definitely I haven't been watching TV news as religiously as when I was at home. And I think I mix in some podcasts and radio here and there, but not much.
What about you,
I
Yasmin?
would say, oh,
No.
sorry. No, I would say the same. I mean, I don't have cable television in college, so it's not really like where I get my news from. But I do try to make a point to read from the different digital outlets.
What about let's talk about your peers a little bit, because this is, obviously the media diet of each generation is very different. So Where do most people in your orbit, in your friend circles, get their news? If they get news at all, are they paying close attention to it? And is it primarily local, national news? Does anybody pay any attention to sort of the local happenings? What does that look like for both of you? Stacey, you want to start?
Yeah. So I think it's interesting because there are a lot of intersections in the way people in my generation get news from social media and traditional outlets, where you see maybe an Instagram post, screenshots a digital outlet or an article, the title of it or some contents of it, and make posts out of that, and people will repost it if it's important, relevant news to on social media. Where there are videos on TikTok where someone's background is a news article and they're just talking about the article in a more communicative, direct way, sort of converting that into an audio visual platform. And so I think that's how a lot of people get information in my generation, at least. So there's a lot of social media, but that doesn't mean that original information don't come from traditional outlet, but it's certainly a new way of accessing it, I would say. And some information are more popular because of the algorithms, the particular kinds of algorithm and trends that are going on. And so that also impact what gets seen and what doesn't.
So they're basically taking this reporting that's been done by the traditional outlet and translating it into a different medium.
Yeah, and it's done by, both people, just random people on the internet, and also I think a lot of news outlets like The Monitor are thinking about how to convert our materials on these platforms so that we can get more eyes on the reporting that we're doing.
Yeah, that is definitely something that we think about quite a bit. Yasmin, what does it look like for you?
So I guess this is pretty specific to, I guess, peers I go to school with rather than I feel like people of my age group in general. I would say for local happenings, my campus paper, the Harvard Crimson, does have very extensive reach on the campus and a very wide readership. So for school happenings, almost everyone I know reads that. And then beyond that, I do feel like the news diet of my peers trends towards national news. And I suspect the way it works is, like Stacey, we have university-wide subscriptions to like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and a couple other outlets. And once you log into those accounts, you get their like push alerts, they're breaking news push alerts to your email. And you can also get newsletters. And I suspect that a lot of people get pinged to read the news when they get those push alerts, because I'll have those emails come up in my inbox, and then I'll check my messages, and I have someone sent an article to the group chat, or someone saying like, oh, did you see this story? Did you see that this is happening? So I do think that email-based outreach is like means a lot for my generation, and a lot of people decide which stories to read based on that.
Now, there's a lot of hand-wringing over people, I guess, sort of all generations, not reading as much as we all used to. You're both nodding. Now, the listeners can't see the video. They're both nodding. In your experience, are people just seeing those push alerts and reading the headline and making inferences from there, or are you all reading the articles or skimming them?
I would say I'm gonna make an educated guess here that a lot of my peers are not reading the article word by word, and it's a lot of reading the headlines and trying to skim from the first paragraph or the second paragraph and ending there. I think with because the way people are engaging with both the digital apps of a lot of news outlets on their phone or through social media, they usually are able to condense a lot of that information in the, for example, in the headline or in a graphic of that article. And so I think there are definitely less people reading full articles word to word in my generation. I would say that I've been in classes where professors would like assign a news article about a particular event going on. And so I think educators are also thinking about how these how news work in our classrooms, and those are, I think, the rare opportunities where everybody's reading the article word to word, unfortunately.
Yeah. What do you think, Yasmin? Does that seem true for you as well? Your peers?
I do feel like people read, and I make that guess just because sometimes I will get screenshots from the middle of an article and my friend will be like, "Can you believe this person said XYZ thing?" So to me, that does indicate that they read, but I will add that I am friends with a lot of humanities and social science majors, so that may sort of correlate with wanting to read the full article. I feel like I can't really speak to my generation as a whole, and I would trust the researchers on that matter more.
It's a biased sample, I guess. Yeah. This is not a scientific study. So, Yasmin, you grew up in Texas, and last year you wrote a piece for The Nation on far-right school board trustees and book banning in Conroe Independent School District, which is the ninth largest school district in Texas. And you were really connecting local politics to the debate over school choice. Tell us a little bit about how that story came about and how you went about reporting it.
Yeah, that piece was interesting because I had pitched it as a profile of the three trustees, these three women who called themselves the Mama Bears. And specifically, I was interested in the tension between women who built their brand around domesticity. In all of their campaign materials, they really emphasize their roles as mothers, and yet were highly influential in the public sphere. So it was pitched as a profile. But it should come as no surprise to the listeners that these women did not want to talk to me at all whatsoever. So I had to pivot sort of midway through the reporting process when it became clear that I wasn't going to have access to them directly. And I made it more of a write-around piece. And it became less about the gendered tensions that I had originally pitched the story on, and more about these connections between politics between this school district and state politics. And that newer angle was one that came out of what sources were saying to me. So this was a really good example of, I think, a story changing and perhaps changing for the better as you report it.
And just take maybe can you give listeners a little bit of an overview of what the article of, what you eventually found and wound up writing about?
Sure. I mean, the article went into sort of individual reasons why these women had decided to run for school board, what they had done since joining the school board, namely banned books. And I connected through that series of events to the debate over school vouchers in Texas. There is an argument that sources, not just related to this school district, but people who are involved with like book bannings in local school districts across, or people who oppose book bannings in local school districts across the country, I should say, that the point of book banning is to undermine trust in public schools, and therefore drum up support for homeschooling in charter schools, which is sort of what school vouchers are related to.
There's actually quite a lot of national reporting at the moment about school vouchers, which has been really fascinating to follow. We don't have them in Maine in the way that they're being used elsewhere in the country, but that's a really interesting connection. Now, so Stacey, you have done a lot of reporting from Western Mass, including for The Shoestring, which is a local news organization in Northampton. You also did an internship with PBS NewsHour, part of which centered on writing media literacy lessons on current news. The lessons were designed to help high school students critically analyze current events and navigate misinformation. That's a fascinating project, obviously, really kind of top of mind for our current environment. So tell us a little bit about that project you did for PBS and what you took away from it.
I really enjoyed it. It's called PBS NewsHour Classroom. And so it's an education component of the PBS NewsHour, which is a larger news organization. And basically, what the website does is it takes reporting that's done by PBS NewsHour and it converts it into basically mini lessons for middle school and high school teachers to be able to use in their classroom and draw news materials into their discussions in a class. And basically there will be, some questions for just like the facts of understanding news, the what, why, where, when, how of news. But then there are also discussion questions that we'll write that are designed to bring more open discussions into the classroom about the news. And also to be able to help students critically think about the news they're reading, the arguments that are made, the content, the specific elements that are in that news, or what's missing from a news article. I remember one of the lesson, media literacy lesson I worked on was on the Supreme Court's Grants Pass decision, which criminalizes homeless encampments. And I remember the questions I wrote for that article. It had a lot of policy discussions. It had the arguments from the Supreme Court to criminalize these encampments. And it also had arguments from experts, policy experts, talking about the impacts, the consequences of this decision, and whether it will actually improve local communities to criminalize encampments. And so I think one of the questions that I wrote was, what do you think with these different arguments that are presented in the article? Who do you think is right? What do you think this decision, this policy actually makes sense for, solving the problem of public safety or homelessness? But the other question was, I think because there were so many policy discussions in the article, the question I wrote was, what else do you want to learn about the situation to be able to form an opinion about homelessness or policies around homelessness? Are there other information you want to hear about, for example, from someone who's unhoused? Or, there are a lot of different sources that can be brought into the discussion that's not just policy experts. And so that was sort of the media literacy component to it, to also understand or at least think about for students what might be missing from an article, instead of just the policy discussion or the different arguments that are presented in an article. And I think it was a really cool experience, not just to be able to do that and know that, these materials are going to be used by students in a classroom. It was also cool for me to be able to think about reporting in a different way, from a different, more critical lens, to think about, what does this anecdote does in an article? What does it mean to bring in personal narratives about this story? And that has helped me in my own reporting, I think.
Now, so I grew up sort of before media literacy training was a thing. I grew up we had typing class when I grew up. But did either of you receive media literacy training either at any level in school, or do you have it now?
I don't think I, at least for me, I don't think I had anything formal. I think when I was in high school, my history teachers maybe had like what drop elements of news in our discussions. to just like be able to talk about media and think about it. But I don't think we had anything formal to talk about, misinformation or being able to critically judge news sources on our own.
Was not, and is there anything available to you in college that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Yasmeen, what about you?
No, I don't recall getting any sort of media literacy training growing up. Media literacy is something I have a concern about in relation to my hometown, just because I'm from like a deep red part of Texas, that sort of lacks a local paper. I think there's sort of like an offshoot of the Houston Chronicle called the Conroe Courier that covers us, but there isn't like a designated local paper. This is true of a lot of places in the United States. And yeah, I mean, I do have a lot of concerns about misinformation in the community that I grew up in, which I feel like really comes to the fore during election years and also really became apparent during the pandemic. I would say in college, I mean, I mentioned to join the paper, you spend an entire semester sort of training. They did build in sort of basic media literacy as well as reporting ethics into that training. So I got a bit of it from there, but I didn't really have it growing up.
And certainly it sounds like not widespread in either of just that outside of your journalistic careers, not widespread in any of your sort of typical elementary, middle, high school classes.
No.
No. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you live in a little bit of a news, or you grew up in a little bit of a news desert, Yasmeen. And I wonder, where do folks in your hometown get their information primarily?
I mean, I don't want to make generalizations about like my entire hometown. It's a big and fast growing area. I remember a lot of friends' parents growing up. Fox News was big. So also there was like sort of a reliance on television, the way that my household also relied on television, albeit through different programs. And I also think social media, Facebook is big for older communities, and Instagram, TikTok is big for people like closer to my age and younger. Yeah, so social media was delivering news to a lot of people. Although we know that, with the way algorithms work, that delivery isn't always impartial.
Right, even though it might be coming from, sort of a bigger, more traditional media outlet that does have an editorial structure, that the way that it is then packaged and put onto whatever social media platform and then, kind of segregated, and the way the algorithm delivers it.
Yeah, and I
Takes
guess I'll also just add, if it's okay, I'll also just add that I think there was a very deep mistrust in mainstream media where I grew up. It was a point of pride that I heard from friends and their parents my entire life. It was a point of pride to say, like, oh, I don't really watch the news. I don't really read the news. There was a lot, yeah, there was deep mistrust in mainstream media. There was a belief in strong liberal bias that pushed people away from news outlets. And yeah, I mean, I guess I'll just say that I think you see that, I think, reflected in like political engagement in my community, and also the polarization of the community in recent years.
A little bit of a point of pride to kind of opt out because it just wasn't trustworthy. Well, I'm going to switch gears a little bit, but you've both served as editors. Yasmin, you served as we mentioned at 15 Minutes, the magazine of the Harvard Crimson, and Stacey, you've served as an editor at the Amherst Student, which is the student publication of Amherst College. Being an editor is very different from being a reporter, so I wonder if maybe Stacey, you can start us off. How has the experience of being an editor been different from reporting for you, and what did you learn from that?
So I would start off by saying that the Amherst Student is a very small college paper, which I imagine is different from Yasmin's experience. It's a very small paper. We have a small staff, and we have volunteer writers. We don't really have writers that we assign a beat to. So things are kind of chaotic a lot of the times, as an editor. But I think the cool thing of being an editor is you get to see all these things that go into the production of newspaper beyond the writing part of it. A lot of it is making sure that we have people who can deliver the newspapers to different parts of campus, or figuring out the management system of our website, learning InDesign to put the things into to design the things in print. Or, if an editor didn't put the links in an article, we have to put the links in the article. So there are just a lot of things that go into producing news that I didn't really see as a writer or as a reporter. And it was really cool to learn about all these things that go into it. I will also say that because we're a small paper, we don't really reject articles. And so we work with writers on their articles till the point that they can be published. And so during that process, there's a lot of feelings. So it's a lot of it was a learning process for me on how to communicate to writers about feedback. I mean, providing feedback is one thing, but also how to communicate those feedback and talking to writers in person through their articles was a big learning experience for me. And I think we were also reporting in some in a time I was an editor during a lot of the major world political events that were happening. And so there was a lot of emotions. And we had a lot of discussion in our newsroom too among the editors about how to handle especially like opinion pieces and op-eds that were coming in. So I think I learned a lot from that, just both on like journalistic ethics, but also how we develop rules and infrastructure in a newsroom that didn't have a lot of those at a time where we had a lot of disagreements with writers or among the editors about what to do. And so definitely a lot of learning as an editor, but I think I also really enjoy being an editor because, as an editor, you spend a lot of time in a newsroom as opposed to doing reporting. We were a weekly paper, and so we get together every Tuesday night and go all the way to 2, 3 a.m. And a lot of the news at a small paper came out of those hours because we're talking to each other about what we've been hearing on campus, what we've been learning, what might be missing from people's discussions. And so a lot of the news that are coming next week are coming out of these discussions from people who all are knowledgeable about campus, who also care a ton about very small things or big things that are happening on campus. So that was a really cool experience for me to be around people that are passionate about this. And to spend a lot of time and to see what a newsroom environment was like.
So that is it is really interesting to have to have that balance, particularly on the editorial side of things. I mean, the Monitor does not publish op-eds or editorial, so we are sort of freed of having to make those kinds of decisions. Talk a little bit more about that, about how did you decide which op-eds to run and maybe which ones to push back on? Did you Did you fact check them? Was it sort of a panel of people working on this? What does that look like at a student paper?
Yeah, so we didn't have any policies before, like Palestine Israel conflict since October 7th. We didn't have policies around what op-eds to publish and what not to publish. Our general policy was that we check the facts and then we publish them. And after that, we had a lot of internal discussions. I was the opinion editor at the time, and we had rejected an article on the basis that it was factually untrue. And it was converted into, and it was a late night discussion that was happening on a two at 2 a.m. You know, we're working on this article, and we just didn't have the writer was just not collaborative enough to make the changes necessary for that article to be actually be able to be published. And that was converted into a thing where the writer was convert was claiming that we won't publish that article on political grounds. And so we had to do a lot of clarifications afterward to explain our policies and to explain to our other editors who weren't on the opinion section why we rejected that article. So we did a lot of explaining in the newsroom, and we published an article to clarify our policies around fact-checking and arrest, harassment or untrue claims about people in our community and other people. And so essentially our policies sort of remain the same. We wanted a policy that don't just apply to Palestine and Israel topics, but also to all of our op-eds, which was having the facts right and not insulting anybody outright in the articles, which are like very, very basic policies, I imagine, for a lot of the op-eds out there, and retaining some of the right as an editorial board in our newsroom to reject an article if we have a certain amount of votes. But that was the general policy that we decided on. But that came out of a lot of discussions within our editorial board from the experience of a couple op-eds during that time.
On campus is very much like living in a very small town. You have to maintain relationships with these people because you will see them regardless all over the place. So you can't just sort of disappear into the mass of people. So Yasmin, what about you? And Harvard has obviously been in the national news quite a bit over the past 6 months. How has the experience of being an editor been different from reporting from you? What have you learned? Just talk to us a little bit about how that's been, particularly maybe in the past year.
Of course. So I've had two different kinds of editing experiences at the Crimson. I spent a year as the magazine's editor at large. So I was mostly editing weekly articles, 800 to 1,000 words every week. Now I'm the magazine chair, which is the equivalent of editor in chief. Me and one other person are co-chairs. And I edit the cover stories, which are around 5,000 words long and reported over the course of several months. I edit 4 to 5 every semester. And I'm also now much more involved with branding and recruitment and audience engagement, and thinking about the magazine sort of like as a brand, as well as thinking about individual content. I would say the biggest thing that I have learned from both of those experiences is to think big picture. I think as a reporter, sometimes it's easy to get fixated on a really powerful quote from a source, or a really cool anecdote that could be the lead, or information that is really interesting to you, the reporter. But the editor's job is to take all of that information and make sure it answers the question of like, what is this story about? And does this information relate to the story and drive the story forward? And it's the editor's job to cut whatever doesn't fit into those parameters, and really kill your darlings. So even though the experiences are quite different, I do feel like thinking structurally and using my editor brain when I'm a reporter is helpful because I do have that big picture in the back of my mind, as the story is taking shape. So the two roles do feed into one another.
That's really, I should have interviewed you both at the very beginning of the summer, so I could have taken your editorial insights. This is great. And it's interesting you mentioned thinking of the magazine as a brand, which is, I think, for journalists of maybe an older generation, there's a very clear sort of firewall between editorial and any kind of advertising, which is still true. Certainly, we have that at the Monitor, but I think just because of the building of like personal brands and the necessity to make sure that people are aware of your work, we're all a little bit in the marketing sphere because we need to promote what we're doing and make sure, sort of let our voices rise out of the fray. So, it's interesting that that's also part of your job at the Crimson, is trying to make sure that the magazine's brand is prominent and is out there. Well, we need to take another quick break. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Main Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. This month, I'm joined by Yasmin Khan and Stacey Zhang, two excellent young reporters who have been with us this summer. Yasmin comes to us from Harvard University with a background in magazine journalism, and Stacey comes to us from Amherst College with a background in local reporting. We have been talking to Stacey and Yasmin about their careers thus far, and we're going to talk to them a little bit more about the reporting that they've been doing for the Monitor this summer and about their plans and experiences trying to make these careers work in a field that seems to be continuously in tumult. All right, so I want to sort of end our conversation here in these last 15 minutes or so by talking about what you have done for the Monitor this summer. You've both done some excellent work, and before we get into all of what you've been reporting on, let's talk about what you entered the summer wanting to learn. So, Yasmin, what were you hoping to learn when you started with the Monitor this summer?
Sure. So on a basic level, I think I wanted more straight news experience. And I wanted to conduct reporting that was really explicitly tied to the community that I was covering. And I feel like I got both of those things. But on a broader level, I was really interested in getting an inside look at a nonprofit news organization. I feel like my prior experiences in journalism and media have been very traditional. My one other media internship was at a print fashion magazine that funded itself through the sale of advertisements. And the Crimson, although it is a campus publication, is over 150 years old. The magazine is like 49 years old, I believe. And the Crimson has an operating budget of $500,000 a year. It's really, so even though it is a campus publication, it is akin to a legacy media outlet in the sense that it's really steeped in history and tradition. So both of those experiences, I would say, were very kind of like old school journalism experiences, whereas nonprofit news feels like this new frontier in the industry, particularly for local news, which is something I think quite a bit about because of because I mentioned the media ecosystem where I grew up. So it's been amazing to get a like behind the curtain look at that at the Monitor.
Yeah, you've been able to. We've done a listening tour this summer, which has been really fun, and I know you've been on a couple of those, which sort of is a blend of us doing some the editorial side and the development side, which is pretty cool. Oh, now, so Stacey, what about you? What were you hoping to learn when you came to us at the beginning of the summer?
Yeah, I agree with Yasmin that I was definitely also interested in how a nonprofit newsroom works in the sort of current climate with media. But I think I was also really excited to learn about just how to put together a long enterprise or investigative piece at an organization that focus on these pieces. They don't we don't pump out like daily stories, quick turnaround stories. We focus more on longer stories. And in my past experience at the Amherst Student and the Shoestring, I did a lot of reporting on quicker turnaround stories like events or local government. So this was a very new experience to be able to pull together a lot of different pieces and try to find the different elements to a story, both doing public records requests and searches, but also interviewing very different people on a particular topic and trying to pull that together and finding an angle to a story that's not just, everything. That has been super interesting to me. I think it definitely seemed really daunting when I was starting, especially in a new state where I don't really understand where to find a lot of these information, or I don't really understand this whole beat or area with a lot of different organizations and personalities and actors. So it's really fun to learn about how to do that, and I feel like now, I guess you didn't say what we have learned, but one of the main things is I feel like I'm more equipped to take on a larger project for stories.
Well, that's great, 'cause that is very much what we do, and I know it's an interesting place to try and have a sort of 12-week experience in journalism, because we operate very differently than, as you both know, than as a daily or a weekly, where even though we are putting out a weekly product, reporters work on stories over the course of several weeks or several months. So we can take a lot of time, which is one of our luxuries and one of the things I love about the Monitor, but it is definitely very different from, I think, most publications. So in our last few minutes here, Yasmin, I want you both to talk about some of the stories that you've done so far. Stacey, I'm going to have you focus on one that isn't out at the time we're speaking, but will be out by the time this airs. It's really exciting. And Yasmin, I want you to talk about, so you came to us this summer with you had a particular interest, like right when you started. You said, I'm very interested in looking at domestic violence in Maine. And you came with a lot of really interesting story ideas, and you wound up doing quite a bit of reporting on domestic violence. And, everyone should go to the website and read all of the stories that Yasmin wrote. They are fascinating. But what I want you to actually talk about is, this is obviously a really sensitive subject where there are a lot of confidentiality issues. Tell us a little bit about how you navigated that and what it was like to report on this in particular.
Yeah, of course. Yes, I did come into the summer wanting to report on domestic violence. It's a very pervasive issue in the state of Maine. Year over year, half of all homicides in the state are domestic homicides. So I did have a sort of deep interest in covering that. In terms of safety and confidentiality, I would say the first thing is it's really necessary. I found that it's really necessary to build trust with your sources. The very first story that I did for the Monitor about federal funding cuts, I mean, the first people I reached out to were executive directors of different domestic violence resource centers across the state, and my sourcing stayed pretty administrative, speaking to people who, by and large, had media training and could speak big picture. And it was only later in the summer, after I had, published clips related to DV and spoken to some of these sources multiple times, that they felt comfortable to connect me with survivors who had a very direct connection to the issues I was reporting on. Whether that be like I did a story about housing for DV survivors. I did another one about coercive control. So it wasn't until these these later stories that I was sort of able to speak with survivors. So that was one thing. When it came to actually sitting down with the survivor and speaking to them, informed consent is so crucial. I mean, I kept like a sort of list of things that I wanted to go over before the interview even started, making sure that people understood what on the record meant, making sure people understood how they would be attributed, making sure they knew sort of how their information would be used in the article, making it clear that people could, stop me, ask me questions at any point. And I think all of that goes into the third thing that I really took away from this reporting experience is that when you're reporting on a subject like DV, I think it's really important to put the safety of your sources first and to really prioritize that. Like I am a journalist. Like I love storytelling and I love, reporting, but I do think that making sure that a person is not like harmed by my reporting is really important. So prioritizing survivor safety is what I try to do when I'm working on this subject.
Yeah, I think you did a really nice job of finding the balance. Stacey, your next story for us, which will be out by the time this airs, is about the Maine Space Corporation and the space industry in Maine. Walk us through a little bit of what you found in looking at the industry, which I think most people have not heard a whole lot about.
Yeah, so my story is about the Maine Space Corporation that was founded in 2022, and a lot of things has happened between then and now. But one of the things was that they're looking into launching sea-based rocket launches, and that came because there are a lot of there not a lot of there are a couple other space companies in Maine. A lot of people know about Blue Shift and their attempts to find a launch facility or find a site for a launch facility in down East Maine. And they've tried in Steuben and also in Jonesport. Both of those attempts were faced with a lot of pushback from the local community. People were concerned about a variety of things, including, noise, ecological impacts, but also how space launches would impact the operations of the fishermen and lobstermen industry. Because when you do rocket launch, you have restrictions on the access to water in a certain perimeter. And that would impact how the access to water for fishing and lobstering. And so there were a lot of concerns, and both towns passed basically laws in their local town to ban these facilities. And because of that, the Maine Space Corporation has been exploring launching rockets from the sea. And they're working they're in discussion with this company called the Spaceport Company, which basically has a lift boat that can load the rocket, sail into the sea, and then launch it from the ocean, where there's you don't really have to pass through a town to be able to have that facility. It's very mobile. It can go however far into the ocean that they're able to. Once they pass all the regulations by FAA, and it's also just easier for regulations because it's not flying over densely populated areas. Well, it's not flying over populations or properties. And so that's the option they're looking at. And for this article, I wrote about that, but also just having giving an explanation of, why does Maine even have a space industry in the first place? When we talk about space or high tech, we're not really thinking about Maine usually. We're thinking about, Houston or Florida or California, where there are existing spaceport facilities or space industry. And what I've learned was that Maine, because of its northern location and the southern facing coast in down East Maine, it provides a really efficient location for launching rocket into what is called a polar orbit, which are orbits that are going from north to south and around the Earth. And there are demands for launching rockets into that orbit as opposed to equatorial orbit, where space rockets coming out of Texas and Florida are flying into. And so Maine has this geographic advantage for that. And that's why there's interest for building a space industry in Maine. And another element to this article was talking about the things that people are concerned about, which is, what regulations exist for these space companies, for the space corporation, and how might that actually impact the local towns or the oceans that the rockets are launched from. And one very interesting, very relevant event that happened in the space industry was the Trump administration recently decided to promote decreased regulations for the space industry in order to what it calls to enable competitions in the space industry. And so that is projected to slash a lot of the regulations in an industry in a variety of ways, in environmental ways, in safety ways. And it's uncertain how Maine as a state will respond to a lot of the potential decrease in federal regulations from the FAA about the space industry. And in Maine, there's sort of different regulatory bodies that might be relevant for space launches. Obviously, there's the FAA environmental and safety assessments that they do at a federal level for these launch operations. And locally, I talked to the Department of Environmental Protection and Department of Marine Resources. I don't know how much more time we have, but they all sort of said that we may have, the Department of Environmental Protection said they may have regulation that may apply, but they can't speculate unless they submit a permit regulation, a permit application with all the information necessary. So they don't have direct regulations on the space industry per se. And so there's some regulations at the state level, but not a lot. And I think there are a lot of uncertainties at the federal level that both legislators and the Space Corporation are waiting to see what happens.
Yeah, there is definitely a lot there. Well, I urge everyone who hasn't read these stories yet to go to the mainmonitor.org. You can find stories by both Stacey and Yasmin there. Thank you both so much for talking to us today and for telling us a little bit about your careers. And yeah, we wish you luck as you head back to school. And one last note. I hope you'll join us at the Common Ground Fair in Unity on September 19th through the 21st. We'll be there all weekend in our bright orange tent. Stop by and say hello to the newsroom and check out our new merch. You can find more details on all of our events at themainmonitor.org/events. You've been listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We were joined today by reporters Yasmin Khan and Stacey Zhang. You can read their work at themainmonitor.org. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. If you have stories you want to share with Stacey or Yasmin, you can find their emails at themainmonitor.org. The Maine Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can also listen on the WERU app. Subscribe to the show as a podcast or download archive shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Kate Koff, and this is Community Radio WERU FM 89.9 Blue Hill. Thanks, everyone.